When she said, I don't dance now, I make money moves, that was a mission statement for a whole new generation.
Respect, but that's not the Mount Rushmore. Listen, cash rules everything around me. When that line dropped, it changed the whole hustle.
The greatest tracks are never finished. They're just debated forever. Introducing the Sprite Living Tracklist. 50 tracks that shape the culture from 6 decades of hip-hop. Scan the QR code on a Sprite or Sprite Zero Sugar to see the full breakdown. Obey your thirst. Sprite.
Hey everyone, I'm Ashley Banfield and this is Drop Dead Serious. I have another development to tell you about in the Lynette Hooker case. And it's about the timeline, because Brian Hooker has a timeline and he's insisting is reality, but it looks a lot more like he's lying about that too. If you watched my last episodes, you will know that we broke the news that Lynette made it back to the boat. We broke the news that, I know Fox News is reporting it, but they took it from us and they didn't credit us. Okay. Lynette Hooker made it back to Soulmate. She did not bounce off the back of the dinghy. That is a lie. That is a Brian Hooker lie. Honestly, we felt it. We knew it. None of his story made sense. But now there's definitive evidence. If you saw my last episodes, there's definitive evidence that Lynette Hooker was dead on Soulmate, that there's evidence of foul play and a fight on Soulmate. So Brian, what's all this business about her bouncing off the boat and then taking the keys with her in the dry bag? And oh no, I had to float all the way to Marsh Harbor, 4 miles that way, because none of that's true. So did you fabricate some kind of a plan to float? And if that's the case, what'd you do with Lynette, your wife? She was dead on your boat, and it wasn't an accident on a dinghy. How did she die, Brian? And where is she? Because she wasn't on Soulmate. At least no one saw her, unless you were hiding her on Soulmate. And there's lots and lots of places on a keelboat, friends. I am a keelboat captain. Bad one. Really lousy at it. But in another life, I captained my own keelboat, 34-foot CNC in Australia for 6 days. And I know that keelboats have so many little cubbies and hideaway lockers. And not all police officers and investigators know about those. I'm just curious. Did Brian put Lynette in one of those lockers while everybody wondered where she was? He lied about so many things, and I'm about to tell you one more thing he lied about. Timeline. Did he also lie about where she was and where he was? Because there were lots of opportunities for him to maybe get rid of Lynette's body well after we thought the emergency was over and Lynette was maybe floating out there somewhere. Maybe he killed her, okay, but then where's the body? Where's the body? Is she floating? Was she anchored down? Was she buried on a beach? Or was she in Soulmate, maybe in one of those lockers, hiding for a later disposal date? All my concepts. Brian's not charged with anything yet, but I keep saying, with the evidence that I'm hearing, that indictment is just minutes away. Maybe weeks, I don't know, but soon. This stuff is deep, dark, ugly, and indicting. These lies he told. And now one more. I can tell you this. There are many people who are working on this case in the Bahamas and in Florida and in Michigan and in California. And I have connected to many of them. And there are other people who are tangentially connected to this case as well. And my sources tell me that Lynette was dead before 8 o'clock p.m. Lynette was dead before 8 o'clock p.m., which tells us again, Brian, you were full of shit. She didn't bounce out of the dinghy at 7:36, which would have been Brian's timeline. We left the Abaco Inn at 7:30, and then we went around the corner and the seas got angry, my friend. And oh no, she bounced out and took the keys with her, and I was left adrift on the heavy high seas, and we got separated. All a lie. Weather was great. It was calm. It was lovely. All you need to do is just check the marine, or you could just check our video that we have put out on prior episodes of the exact area where he says the seas were so rough and they were calm as glass, and our photographs. We've shown it. Everything he's told is a lie. And now, one more lie. She was dead before 8 p.m. That's a fact. My sources are telling me she was dead before 8 p.m. The exact time, can't tell you yet, working on it. However, if that's the case and they made it back to soulmate, what'd he do? Did he do anything? How did Lynette die? Because with evidence of foul play on board, evidence of a fight, and she's dead before 8, oof. Oh, Brian Hooker, tick tock. I said it before, I'll say it again. I hope you had a really nice autumn last year because I don't think you're going to see another one. Just me talking. He's not charged with anything yet. I've also got some brand new photos that I want to share with you that were given to me by Dan and Kathy Shepherd. And you'll know that Dan Shepherd is Lynette's dad. These are really sweet photos of Lynette and Dan, and also Lynette and Dan and Carly, his granddaughter, Lynette's daughter. Just really, I mean, it's really special to be able to bring Lynette to life because she's not just a name. She's not just a statistic. Lynette was a wonderful woman, and she had some incredible friends and family and coworkers who love her dearly, said she was just salt of the earth. Brian, not so much. They didn't say the same about him. None of them said the same about him. They said the opposite. Dirtbag. Liar. Asshole. Anti-establishment. Mean. Conniving. That's the stuff we got about Brian from everybody we've talked to. I haven't heard one person who said, he's a good guy. No, nothing. So I wanted to show you some of these really lovely pictures of Lynette. And my great thanks to Kathy and Dan Shepherd for sharing them. So let me tell you a few more things. If you think about the timeline and how that factors into Lynette getting back on board. Then there's the whole idea of why did he plan a float? Why did he plan a float to Marsh Harbor, right? And that whole 9 hours, like, yeah, it don't take five. It doesn't take 9 hours, y'all. Everybody we spoke with, marine experts, the Coast Guard, search and rescue. I mean, I met the Coast Guard members over there when I was in Bahamas. I mean, they were right there on the dock with me and at the Abaco Inn. And they were trying to piece this all together too. But every expert that we've spoken to says, no, it ain't 9 hours. And the captains that we've spoken to, those guys who live there, work there, boat there every day, they said, no, wouldn't take 9 hours for a dinghy. So what was his plan? And why this big story of, oh, I threw the anchor out north of Lubbers and shot off my flare? Why all that? What was Brian Hooker trying to fabricate? Because we know now there was no need to float because they made it back to soulmate. So all this other stuff is just horse shit. But why? What was he trying to cover up? What was he trying to get us to think? Well, maybe he was thinking of something else. Like how to get rid of Lynette, maybe? Because she's dead on board soulmate after evidence of foul play and a fight? There's something else that is throwing a monkey wrench into this. Do you remember that photo that we got at Drop Dead Serious? Exclusive photo that we found of Lynette taking the final picture we think might exist of her, the selfie. It's a photo of Lynette taking a picture on the far left-hand side of the pool. Brian's over there on the right-hand side of the pool. Witnesses said, people who took the picture, that he looked like he was brooding, skulking, looking into the ocean, looked unhappy and angry. And there's Lynette, apparently, who was dancing. So we have a still photo, but the witnesses said when they took the picture, she was dancing by herself, enjoying herself, while Brian's over there brooding on the other side of the pool. And one thing that really stood out, other than those details, which are big, was the watch that she was wearing. Because you can clearly see this powder pink band on her wrist as she's taking that photo. Some people said, what about a tan line? Nope. She didn't have a tan line like that. That's an insane tan line, right? That was an Apple Watch. And her daughter Carly said she had a powder pink Apple Watch. So we imagined that when an Apple Watch was seized on board the boat, oh my God, that must be her Apple Watch. She made it back to the boat. But now we are learning there may have been two. May have been two Apple Watches. and that Apple Watch on her wrist at the pool may still be with her body, which tells me Apple Watches have so much information. They can tell you when you die. They can tell you when your heart stops. They can tell you when you're agitated. All this stuff is recorded. All of it. My heart rate is being recorded right now as we speak. And if I fall on the floor, I get a message saying, "Are you okay? We detected a hard fall. Should we call 911 for you?" Oh my God. The amount of information that her Apple Watch, were it still on her wrist when she got back to Soulmate, could be enormous. And she could still be wearing it. So Carly, her daughter, told us that she often takes her watch off, puts it on the charger, because it dies really quickly. The battery dies really quickly. But what if that wasn't what she did? What if she kept that watch on? And there's another older powder pink banded Apple Watch on the boat. I know that I have two exactly like this, same band and everything, in my desk drawer. Maybe that's the same. Maybe there is a wealth of data on the Apple Watch that she had on, if there are in fact two. And that's what we're hearing. There may be in fact two of the exact same watch, and that the watch they seized may not be the watch we saw in the picture. God, I hope that's the case. God, I hope everything was recorded, every moment. And maybe that's why we now know she was dead by 8. Maybe that's why we know. There could be other digital reasons. There could be all sorts of reasons. I know the Alexa, I can't say it too loud, records all sorts of stuff, right? Maybe something happened like that. But wow, what a timeline. And speaking of timeline, you know that photo that we also got exclusively here at Drop Dead Serious? Of Brian Hooker leaving the Abaco Inn, seemingly by himself. He's walking alone, and he is walking towards the beach and then the dock where his dinghy was parked. And we know his dinghy was parked there because we got a picture of it. And we all also have witnesses who said, oh boy, that dinghy beside us was really trashy and messy and dirty. And we have all sorts of witnesses who say, yes, that is exactly how they kept their dinghy. And we can see in the picture their dinghy is at the dinghy dock. And then we can see in another picture Brian at exactly 7 o'clock on the nose. He is walking towards the dinghy dock with his big floppy hat on and his seemingly blue pattern shirt. The witnesses at Abaco Inn told us he was wearing a blue and white pattern shirt. Jim Todd told us when he pulled him off of Marsh Harbor, he was wearing a blue pattern shirt. Other people said it looked like he had a gray tan shirt when he was at Abaco Inn, which makes me wonder if he had two. I used to have an extra shirt in my dry bag. Whenever I went out in the dinghy, off the sailboat, into land, I would have extra stuff. Because you get splashed all the time in the dinghy, right? Big wave, windy stuff, whatever happens. You get splashed. Somebody goes by, you go over their waves, you know. So maybe he had two shirts. I don't know. But that photo at 7 o'clock, we are also learning it's possible that Brian and Lynette might have just left right after that. So this whole, we left Abaco Inn at 7:30, doubtful, doubtful. Maybe a lot earlier. I think Brian maybe was trying to create all sorts of scenarios because he sure spun a big yarn about his wife bouncing off his dinghy, taking the keys with her, and then, oh no, the dry bag's gone, Lynette's gone, and I have no propulsion because I lost one of my oars. Also bullshit. I've been in a dinghy before, and if you can touch the bottom with your oar, which in that area you kind of can, you can just pull yourself to shore, even with big waves. And if you're a former Marine, and he's former, I don't consider somebody with these morals once a Marine, always a Marine. This guy's former. He doesn't display any of the Marine qualities that I know of United States Marine Corps. This guy's a former Marine. You can't paddle against the waves. I can. I mean, and I'm 5'6". And I'm a girl. And I can do it. But you couldn't save your wife. It was all bullshit and we knew it. And now we know for sure. Now we have the evidence on board to prove it. Foul play on board. That was exclusive information we brought you 2 episodes ago. So Fox News, it would be nice if you would credit us when you report our stuff. I always credit Fox Digital all through the Nancy Guthrie. Every single day I credited all of their information because they're really good at what they do. It's just that next time it would be nice if they would credit us when we found that stuff exclusively, and we did. Couple of other things. Still a lot of forensic results to come in. There's been great work done by the FBI lab at Quantico. And before you say, oh, it's FBI, nope. This is all United States Coast Guard. Coast Guard Investigative Service. That's the group that's at the helm of this. They call themselves CGIS. If you have tips, they have an app, CGIS. Just app it up and it can be anonymous. But CGIS has been at the helm of this. They've done a really, really good job. And they have enlisted the help of the FBI lab at Quantico. Apparently, they have been amazing. And there's more to come, which is good. I also wanted to show you something that I've sort of been noodling for a while, and I wanted to show it to you tonight because it just sits odd with me. I wanted to show you Lynette Hooker's final Facebook post, because now in light of it all, I just cannot believe that this was the meme that she chose to share. I mean, we all share memes about all sorts of things all the time, but this one was her final meme that she shared. It says, "My obituary will read, she loved hard, lived loud, and should not have been left unsupervised. She said fuck more times than anyone could count. Never learned her lesson and managed to turn every questionable decision into a story people still talk about years later." In any other time, that would be hilarious. It's kind of like me. I say an F-bomb all the time. But I'm just so devastated that this was her final post about what her obituary would read as a joke. And I wanted to share it with you because I see her as just so fun-loving, and she had no idea what was coming. This was March 30th. She would be dead in 5 days. It stays with me. That post about what her obituary would read. And it was sent in fun. And 5 days later, she'd be dead and possibly murdered, because the Coast Guard has called this a murder investigation. I have a guest on today's episode that I think is so critical to looking at the Lynette Hooker case. And it's because he worked for CGIS for years, the Coast Guard Investigative Service. And he was at the helm of another case at sea where a woman mysteriously drowned when the boat sank and they never found her body. But boy, did they ever, I want to say, solve the case. It's a weird thing because let me lay it out for you. And you may have seen this on Netflix. It's the case of Nathan Carman. Does that ring a bell? Nathan Carman from Rhode Island, 22 years old. Back in 2016, he was rescued from a life raft. And it looked like a miraculous rescue because he had been at sea, he said, for 7 days. Went out on a fishing trip with his mom, Linda, and then the boat sank and he got to the rescue raft and she didn't. And 7 days later, he's rescued. But he doesn't look like he's got any of the signs of someone who's been at sea needing rescue for 7 days. Like, he's not dehydrated. He hasn't lost weight. He's not burned. All that business that, you know, somebody who is in a sinking boat and scrambles for their life and their mom can't make it. And so they knew something was up. And eventually, Nathan Carman was charged. 8-count federal indictment. CGIS. They helmed this case. Murder on the high seas. Murder on the high seas for allegedly killing his mom. But then he was also charged with mail fraud and wire fraud and a whole bunch of related fraud counts. They said this whole murder of his mom was a fraud to get the money that he was due from his grandfather and inheritance. The money, big money, was supposed to come from his grandfather down to his mother and then eventually down to him. But with mom out of the way, he gets all the money from granddad. Now, the granddad thing is interesting too, because granddad died mysteriously, gunshot. That was in 2013. John Chakalos, I might be pronouncing it wrong, but that was a mysterious death as well. And the suspicion was is that Nathan probably did that one too. But they had him arrested and they were getting ready for the federal trial. And wouldn't you know it, Nathan decided to take his own life in jail. That happened in 2023 before he could be tried for mom's death. Now, why would he do that? All signs pointed to the fact the feds had this, right? All signs pointed to the fact that the jig was up, that they had him dead to rights. But my question for the lead agent from CJIS on this case was, without a body, what were all the things you did to get the evidence you needed in order to get that 8-count federal indictment? Because something tells me there may be similarities in the Nathan Carman case, headed by CJIS, and the Lynette Hooker case, headed by CJIS. And the lead detective on that case is Eric Gemp. He's retired now, but Eric was in law enforcement for 26 years. He did 5 years in the Secret Service as well, and then did 21 years with CJIS. So he knows a thing or two about murder on the high seas, because if that's what we're dealing with Lynette Hooker, murder on the high seas, I can see a lot of parallels between these two cases. And now I want to know what the parallels are, maybe in the investigation. It's a bit of guesswork, but it's guesswork coming from the smartest people in the room, and that's Eric Gemp. And one of the key things that Eric Gemp and his team at CJIS did when they rescued Nathan Carman from this 7-day miraculous, float after mom died and the boat sank crisis, was they decided to enlist the Coast Guard's search and rescue team, the SAR team, right? And they mapped out all the probable areas where Nathan and Linda had gone fishing. Right? And then they developed this whole drift scenario. Because if your boat goes down and you're in a life raft and you're just drifting without propulsion, there are ways to find out if you landed in the place you should have landed. So they mapped out the drift scenario with their computer programming tools based on the wind and the ocean currents, and then it gave them a probable search radius. And we know that that happened in the Lynette Hooker case. It happened early with just ballparking, and it seemed a little off. At first it seemed on, and then it seemed off when more data came in. And we know it happened in the Nathan Carman case as well. But there's so much more they did. There's so much more forensics that they were able to get. And I think in the Brian Hooker case, there's a possibility of premeditation. Because if she's dead on the boat by 8 p.m., you got to have a plan. And you got to execute that plan. And it seems like things were executed pretty well if, in fact, he killed her. I'm not saying he did. He's not charged with killing her. But I think he's going to be, based on everything we're seeing. When I talk about prior statements and premeditation, I think about what Lynette herself said to her friend Rachel and said to her mother Darlene about an attack that she alleges happened at the hands of her husband Brian Hooker. This happened over a year ago. And what Lynette told mom and friend was that Brian had strangled her into unconsciousness, that she had heard her neck crack and had her back thrown up against a part of the sailboat that was really hard. I think the back area where you'd sit outside. And that the next day, when she was packing her stuff to leave, Brian Hooker said to her, and I'll quote, "I should have finished the job and thrown you overboard," is the allegation that Lynette made to her friend and to her mother. Contemporaneous reporting about this alleged attack, that this happened, she photographed bruises, saying, "I just don't want this to happen again. This is a reminder to myself. These bruises are a reminder to myself to not let it happen again. But I should have finished the job and thrown you overboard," she says, was the statement that was made to her by her husband the day after this alleged attack. Not, "I'm so sorry, I don't know what came over me." Not that, even that isn't good enough, but "I should have finished the job and thrown you overboard." Those are the kind of statements that make you wonder, she did end up, in his words, overboard. I don't think that's what really happened. Was it premeditated? But I want to talk with Eric Gemp because, again, smartest guy in the room, and he knows a thing or two about murder on the high seas, and I keep wondering if that's what we're dealing with. So here's my conversation with Eric. Eric, thank you so much for joining me on Drop Dead Serious. It's good to talk to you because, honestly, you're the smartest guy in the room when it comes to murder on the high seas. You've literally gone through a case with no body, with a woman who went overboard or went down with the ship, and you had stories told to you by somebody who was alleged to have lied about everything. I wanted to get your initial reaction to this reporting that we've received on Lynette Hooker, that she died on board Soulmate. She didn't bounce off the back of the dinghy.
So this is the first time that I'm hearing that. And I think it's pretty interesting, an interesting development. I'm sure the investigation is, obviously currently ongoing. But my thought on that is, with all of the, conflicting stories that have been presented so far, I don't think I'm terribly surprised by that, by the statement, and by that finding.
Were you ever able to question Nathan Carman? Because I'm always curious what someone says before he or she realizes, oh dear, I'm a suspect.
We never had the opportunity to interview Nathan. We were prepared to interview Nathan the day he was arrested. But at that time, when we identified ourselves and the reason that he was being arrested, he chose not to be interviewed and requested his attorney.
That's always, someone's right. We all have a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. And I always tell people, you should. You should exercise that right. Even if you're innocent, you should exercise that right. It's frustrating for investigators, though, that's for sure. And in the case of Brian Hooker, he gave multiple statements, apparently, to the Bahamian authorities. From what I understand, the Coast Guard hasn't received those yet, and the Bahamian authorities are in the process of shipping them over. I don't know how they ship them, digitally or by, steamership, but we're a long ways out from, Lynette's disappearance. But those initial statements to the Bahamian authorities are going to be gold, aren't they?
They are. They are. And I think that, if I'm drawing parallels between the Nathan Carman case and this Brian and Lynette Hooker case, the initial statements in Nathan's case was also extremely valuable, because following the initial statement, there were several changes and added added details along the way, as he realized that there was heightened scrutiny on what he had stated, and once he became aware that there was an ongoing investigation.
So he must have spoken to the rescuers, right? Like, if your story is, I'm a victim, help me, rescue me, I've just been through tragedy, it is only natural that you are speaking to your rescuers and then speaking to any other responding authorities. In those particular comments, what did Nathan say or do that raised the spidey senses of the people who may have initially smelled a rat?
So the largest thing that sticks out to me, so when Nathan was rescued, he spoke to the crew on the Orient Lucky. That wasn't really in detail about what had transpired and how the boat had sunk. While he was on the Orient Lucky transiting back to Boston, he had contacted his aunt, and that was what I would consider sort of the first statement that he makes to a family member about what had transpired. And in that statement, he told his aunt that the boat had sunk at night. And that was the initial statement that we were operating on, because it's the first time that we had heard from Nathan during that time. Other than he also spoke to the District 1 Command Center at the time of his recovery. But once he made it back to Boston, he ended up being interviewed by three Coast Guard members, and that was called a SAR debrief, search and rescue debrief. And that was ordinarily something that had that the Coast Guard conducts, and that's really a best practices type of interview. What can we do better? Because the Coast Guard, during the 8-day time frame that Nathan was missing, searched 64,000 square nautical miles, and that number might not mean anything to anybody, but when you overlay that, that's virtually all of New England. So, and when the best in the world for search and rescue doesn't find what they're looking for. That raised a question for me. But when we found out that he mentioned that he had first sunk at night, like I said, when he told his aunt, and then the story changed a few days later that he had sunk midday. That was a big change in story. And that was maybe a couple of days later. So there was an opportunity to, what I believe, an opportunity to reflect and begin to realize that there was some scrutiny that was being placed on the validity of his story.
Well, it's incredible. Obviously, you know, what he said originally was untrue. And what he said next may have been the truth or may have been untrue, but you can't have both. So one of them was an untruth. And in the case of Brian Hooker, we now have a colossal untruth. It's a lie. It's just a flat out lie. You can't possibly have floated off to Marsh Harbor with no propulsion because Lynette bounced out of the dinghy with the keys, right? And we can't possibly have Lynette bouncing out of the dinghy with the keys because Lynette was dead on board Soulmate. So they made it back to that boat. So an untruth, that colossal, is that the whole ball of wax? Is that like hook, line, and sinker? You know, like use any expression you want, but is that the kind of thing where a jury says, you're the kind of liar who looks like he did kill his wife?
I don't believe that's the end all be all. I think that is just one statement. And certainly you do have to back that up with additional evidence. I think there's certainly enough room to be able to say, you know, maybe I misspoke or something along those lines. Is that one statement enough? Not in my mind. And I don't think that a jury would disagree.
Wow, I'm shocked. I feel like here's a guy who had us all wound up and had rescuers looking for his wife, just like you were, you know, Coast Guard was looking for Linda Carmen, and said it would take a higher authority to have anyone stop him looking for his wife. And that higher authority was a flight out of the Bahamas the next day. It was a very high authority, lots of altitude. But there's no other reason. Like, I just can't come up with any other defense. You got evidence of foul play on board and that she's dead on board. And yet this entire story that's concocted and put together of this massive float and then enacted, like the whole fake scenario is enacted. I mean, look, I've done a lot of cases where somebody says it was an accident and I freaked out, but this is beyond that.
No, I would agree with you that the story alone is certainly lends itself to cast doubt on the individual. I do think that there's a difference. You know, as an investigator, we're doing our very best to follow every single lead that we possibly can, that we think logically needs to be followed. But there's certainly a different threshold once you enter the courtroom. And, you know, there's, you know, likely a prosecutor in this case that, has been consulted, maybe at a minimum, maybe there's something else going on. Maybe there's, you know, some sort of grand jury or some sort of proceeding that's going on. But at a minimum, I'm inclined to think that there's a prosecutor that's been consulted, and just the mere fact that there was a statement that was made and that it is in direct contradiction to logic, doesn't get you to the point you need to get to. There's certainly similarities between these cases, and quite honestly, that's what got my attention initially back in, I think it was early April, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Easter.
Nearly 100 days ago. And when I was looking, initially reading about this case, I was shocked at the similarities, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Me too, which is why I wanted to call you. Were there any other secrets and tricks of investigation that you employed in the Carmen case? Other than we heard his statements and they were off kilter, what other magic did you weave? Like, tell me what you did digitally. If I mean, listen, 2016 was different, but what did you find? What did you do that led you to some conclusions?
So I think right up front, there was no magic. This was just built. This case and the success of this case was built on partnerships with our local and federal law enforcement, the FBI, and the South Kingstown, Rhode Island Police Department. And it was literally interviews, a tremendous amount of examination, computer examination, computer forensics, reviewing mountains of data.
So tell me about that, because that's really what I'm getting at. Like, what kind of forensics, digital, computer, data, all of that, what kind of forensics did you zero in on that really gave you the smoking gun?
Well, quite honestly, we never had the smoking gun. Again, this was a case, the Carmen case was built on breadcrumbs is how I've always phrased it. It was just incremental pieces of the puzzle that were slowly coming together. And in our case, what we did is we had seized a number of electronics, computers, cell phones, and we began to forensically extract the data from those and review the data. And there was, and that included emails going back as far as we could get the emails on these whatever piece of equipment was being examined. Cell phones, the same thing. Text messages, photographs on the on the computers, and I don't remember exactly how many there were, but there was, I'm going to say at least five computers and multiple phones that really provided us some insight. And that insight was were photographs from previous fishing trips that Linda had stored on her computer, and emails that she had sent to Nathan, and it gave us a little bit of insight as to the nature of their relationship. While this is going on, we are also what I would consider rebuilding Nathan's life to the extent that we can. We were serving process for financials on different institutions. We were examining his spending history. And one of the most important things we did was create a timeline. We were trying to determine if there was a pattern of purchases associated with the timeline. But more importantly, it gave us a little bit of insight initially as to what his paths of travel were, to see if there were any patterns. But what we noticed, certainly in August of 2016 and September of 2016, noticed some purchases that were just really what I considered out of the ordinary. It was multiple anchors purchased during that period of time, a desalination device for that would have been on the boat to have fresh water if you're underway for an extended period. A number of fishing tackle items, but nothing that would have led you to believe that he was going to be prepared to go offshore tuna fishing. Once we began to review the photos, in particular photos that we had obtained from the South Kingstown Police Department following the seizure of Nathan's pickup truck and having it be impounded, we noticed that there was a bucket of eels in the truck. And eels traditionally would have been used as bait. And if these were left behind, what are you going to use for bait? So I started this list of just things that, you know, may have had a place at some point, but weren't making sense to me in the sequence, because Linda and Nathan had left at night. They were, if they were planning to go offshore, if Nathan was planning to go offshore, there's certainly things that he should have had on the boat that he didn't have on the boat: ice, food, change of clothes, because he was an inexperienced boater. And as the investigation unfolded pretty rapidly in that 5 days, or 7 days, while as that investigation unfolded in that 7 days that he was missing, there were just more questions than answers. In particular, we found out at that point that Nathan had been also cut out of Linda's will during that time that he was missing. So these items that we were discovering became cumulative, and he had an opportunity to speak to us if he wanted to after he was rescued, and his attorney did not permit that. And that was unfortunate because he was rescued in late September of 2016. He met with the SAR debrief team when he returned to Boston. His attorney permitted him to be interviewed by the detective from South Kingstown, Rhode Island Police Department, but not me. And after that, that was the last time we would have had the opportunity to interview him until he was arrested.
But the SAR interview and the police interview, that must have been at least a wealth of information for you. Very valuable.
Certainly both of them. But for different reasons. The SAR interview began to lay out the timeline and what I would consider an official statement of a change in story. Mm-hmm. Because when he first... Like I said earlier, when he first spoke to his aunt, he said that he and Linda had sunk at night. When he spoke to the SAR debrief team, he said that he sunk midday on the 18th, and that really stood out to me because he was clearly not telling the truth to one of the people. And he clearly was not telling the truth either to the Coast Guard or his aunt. We didn't know which one at that time he wasn't telling the truth to, but what we did know is we had a significant deviation from his story, from his initial story.
If Lynette is never found, or Lynette's remains are never found, a lot of people say no body, no case, and that's just not true. You're living proof of that. Was that a huge hindrance to your case that you never found Linda?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a huge hindrance to the case that we were unable to find Linda and or the boat. But it did not deter us because we realized that at a minimum, the boat is probably in somewhere around 7,000 feet of water, and the likelihood of finding the boat was not something that we were hopeful. We just didn't have the resources, and the ocean is just so vast that there would just not be any way that we think we could pinpoint. We think we know where Nathan was based on his statement he provided in December of 2016. He said he was in an area called Block Canyon out on the continental shelf. And at that point, we had a known location, but he was rescued a significant distance east of the location that he said where the boat sunk. With all the drift analysis that was provided to us by the Coast Guard and the experts, there's no way that he would have drifted west when the drift would have taken him further east towards New Jersey.
So, I mean, it sounds like the case was being built on conflicting statements, which are impossible to, I mean, when you're in a crisis, you know if it's middle of the night and you know if it's day. If your mom is going down and you're grabbing a lifeboat, you know if it's bright daylight and you can see her, or if it's, you know, dark of night and you can't. So that's really hard to explain away to a jury, right?
Can't yeah.
Just think, oh, it was a couple of hours. I was mistaken. No. It's a whole world of difference, you know?
Yeah. And early on, we began to get witness statements that were telling us, okay, there was a desire to go fish by the windmills southeast of Block Island. And so we started to map how he would have gotten there. There's only two ways that he could have gotten there. You're going to go down the east side of Block Island, or you're going to go down the west side of Block Island. One statement that he provided, he said he went down the east side of Block Island. Another statement, he said he went down the west side of Block Island.
Oof.
So that's not a that's not an oversight.
Small discrepancy.
That's not an oversight.
That so, and also the drift patterns. I mean, this is just good hard science that that couples with somebody's inability to keep a story straight. And I keep wondering about Brian Hooker and the things that he's told to the Royal Bahamian Police Force. They haven't forwarded those statements yet to Seabiss. I'm under the understanding that they're in the process of doing so. So I highly encourage them to speed up the process, since we are 90 plus days since her disappearance. And those critical statements are going to mean the world to Seabiss, I'm sure. Especially since they have found so much that is inconsistent, so much of his story that's a lie. I really want to know what he said to the police.
Yeah, those statements are going to be key that the Bahamian police are going to provide. Those are first observations, early observations, and those are going to be key. Why it's taken so long is pretty astounding. It seems like there's... I don't know the reason behind it, but I do know that when those statements get in the hands of Seabiss, that's going to be I don't know that I would call it a game changer, but that's certainly going to be something that fills in the blanks along the way. Because right now they're operating on many unanswered questions.
There's a big difference between 2016 and... in 2026 when it comes to digital forensics and, you know, Apple watches and cell phones and triangulations, even, you know, Starlink and internet. And I would imagine that there's even better marine technology. What do you expect Seabiss is doing in order to nail down this case against Brian Hooker?
I think there's several different things going on. I think they're still probably attempting to identify people that need to be interviewed, maybe some witnesses that they haven't discovered yet, or haven't been spoken to yet. I think that there's certainly this computer forensics component that is going to really also fill in the timeline. The advance in technology, like you mentioned, is going to be a critical point, because whether it be the Apple Watches or the Starlink, or if there's any surveillance cameras on the boat, any electronics from the boat, I imagine that some of the equipment on the boat has some type of redundancy, electronic redundancy on it, that you be able to get additional information on. And this is all about filling in a timeline, and creating, a picture, if you will. And I think that while, yes, 2016 is different, and the advancement in technology, is a world of difference. The process doesn't change. They are in possession of electronics. These electronics hold a massive amount of data, and to extract the data and then review the data takes a large amount of time, if you're going to do it correctly. It's not, because you don't want to overlook something. Something in this case is so critical, you don't want to overlook, and you don't want to just assume something. You want to make sure that you're viewing it and making sure that, okay, have I missed anything? So while the case is 100 days old, it's still very much in its infancy, particularly when it comes to reviewing electronics, because there's, every piece of electronic just holds a massive amount of data.
And it's a ripple effect. Everything it has can cause brand new warrants, and that process isn't quick either. And when it comes to a federal case, I've tried to mention on the podcast multiple times, it's different than state cases. You get to probable cause usually at the state level, and you arrest and you hopefully withhold bail if it's a murder, and then you build the case for the next 2 to 3 to 4 to, I've covered one after 10 years. Feds are a little different. You guys front load all of that work before you get to an indictment and arrest, and then you're ready to go to trial within months.
Yeah, and the federal cases are generally different because of the speedy trial clock. When the cases are front loaded, so the government is assured that they are ready to go with a prosecution. The state cases operate a little bit differently. In the end, the goal is to hopefully gain a conviction, but the federal cases do front load the investigation and make sure that the date that the individual is arrested, the government is prepared to go to trial.
Do you think there's any massive similarity in terms of what CJIS investigators are doing right now to pin down what happened to Lynette and why Brian Hooker may have killed her? Because this is a murder investigation. And your investigation, what happened to Linda Carman? Do you think there's something particularly that's very similar in how you guys are attacking these cases?
I do, from a foundation standpoint, and I think there are a number of similarities. It might not be a contributing factor from an evidentiary standpoint, but you've got a spouse and a close family member whose sudden disappearance at sea in both cases. Only truly one witness in each case who was on the boat at the time of the disappearance, or in the Carman case, the time the boat sunk. The questionable narratives that have been provided and the changing narrative, both provided implausible explanations of what took place. And for me, in the Carman case, that was something that really, really stood out to me. For Nathan, the implausible explanation started with how the boat sunk. And the boat sunk bow first and suddenly sunk. And when he surfaced, the life raft was already deployed. And late in the investigation, we identified that sequence that he provided was just completely implausible. And I believe Nathan and Brian never anticipated federal law enforcement, more specifically CJIS involvement, and they never anticipated that this case would garner as much attention by a United States federal law enforcement agency. Both of them have family members and friends raising doubts about their disappearance. And I could probably go on and on, but those are just a handful of similarities between the two cases. Like I said earlier, from an evidentiary standpoint, those are just foundation components. Those are what I view as foundation components to a case. Brian's story that he was never going to leave the island, or it would take an act of God or
higher power, right? And he's an atheist too, by the way. He's an atheist and he's calling on a higher power.
It would take a higher power for him to leave the island. And given the opportunity, he no sooner given the opportunity, and he left the island. And I think that while not a truly an evidentiary item, I think it speaks volumes to the individual, and I think it speaks volumes to the case. Where it fits in the case, I don't know where it fits in the case, but it's just one of those things that is not a doesn't seem like it's a natural response to the right. situation.
You can explain away a couple of behaviors, but you can't continue to explain all of your behaviors and your inconsistencies and your lies and your, you know, fleeing the country and lying to the press about it. Listen, not all heroes wear capes, but I think CJIS is amazing, and I've been super impressed with everything they've been doing. Let's hold out hope that you and I will meet with different news, that there's an arrest and maybe there's a trial afoot.
I hope so too. That would mean it was a successful investigation. I would temper any enthusiasm. I mean, I think that probably great strides have been made, but these cases are built incrementally, and I would I wish the investigators the best of luck because I think that they are certainly on the right path. But it's just one of these cases that it's going to take time. And unfortunately, family and friends probably don't want to hear that. But that's the reality of it. The agents aren't going to cut any corners. They're not going to take any shortcuts. They are going to make sure that they put together an absolutely solid case to the best of their ability.
Eric Gemp, great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ashley. Appreciate the opportunity.
And thank you for your service.
Appreciate it.
My great thanks to Eric Gemp. That's the kind of guy whose mind I want to tap when there is this seemingly parallel case that's happening in the Bahamas. His case happened in Connecticut. But lots of lies told, right? Inconsistencies, science that proved some of those inconsistencies. And I will be so fascinated when eventually I hope we get to see the case that the Coast Guard Investigative Service is mounting against Brian Hooker, because it's a murder investigation. We were the ones who brought that to you first. And we will continue to bring you news as we learn it. I am working tirelessly. My sources in the Bahamas, my sources in America. Here I am up in Canada. This is truly an international affair. But I'll bring you what I can when I can. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. Thank you for subscribing. And thank you also for being a member. New member Q&A, Ask Me Anything coming soon. Keep your eyes peeled. I'll have that set for you. I'll give you lots of notice. In the meantime, truth isn't just serious. It's drop dead serious.